Welcome to Brain Junk. I'm Amy Barton.
And I'm Trace Kerr. And today it's everything you never knew you wanted to know about. Cool stuff that happens in your brain. I think I'm going to get a quiz. I'm so excited.
You are. You're totally going to get a quiz. Are you ready?
I'm totally ready.
Okay.
I have my pen. I have my paper.
You want to do that one first? Let's do that one first.
If you're going to make me do math, I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to fail.
There is the first activity, actually. Yes. The first activity does not involve your pen and paper.
Oh, okay.
I want you to think about the taste of chocolate, how it's silky and sweet or dark and bitter. And now I also want you to add 47 and 56, but I want you to continue thinking about how chocolate tastes.
I can't add in my head.
I don't even know how much it is, too. So keep trying. Give it a go.
47 plus 56.
And the taste of chocolate, how it's sweet and
I really
kind of
can't.
Earthy.
47 and 6 is 13.
And
carry
are you
the
thinking
one.
About chocolate still?
49 is 10, so 103?
Probably.
Oh
so,
my
okay.
God.
So are you still thinking about or tasting that chocolate?
I had no chocolate. All I had was the panicky feeling from seventh grade when I knew I was going to fail a test. Thank you for that.
A little
that.
Bit coppery and
it was awful.
At Lab in the Wild, they talked about this, where I found this one test. They said that a lot of people had that fuzzy, unripe banana feel in their mouth instead of chocolate as
totally.
They're doing that
yes.
math. You want to try the other one? Grab your pen and paper.
You're going to make me do more math.
Okay, and brain junkies out there, if you want to play along, you need a device that can act as a stopwatch, and you need a paper and a pen. So, because you can pause, we're going to move right along because you've paused us. All right. So, you are going to now spell a phrase out loud as you simultaneously write your name. So you'll be writing your name, and when you're ready, tell me you're good ready. And I'll
Wait,
tell you the
but
phrase.
What, oh, you'll
write
tell
your
me the
name,
phrase as I do it?
And I want you to, well, you're going to write your name, and I'm going to tell you the phrase right now. Jewelry is shiny. Ready?
And I have to spell that?
You have to spell it out loud and write your name.
You're giving
ready?
Me two tasks.
Take a deep breath. Okay. Go. Spelling your name.
J-E, oh my God. J-E-W... I can't spell jewelry.
Give it your best shot.
E-L-R-Y-I-S-S-H-I-N-Y. Thank God my name is short.
Okay.
I don't think I spell jewelry right. J-E-W-E-L-R-Y. Okay. That was embarrassing.
I'm getting a pen. Okay. Now, I'm writing your time down. I'm shouting at the microphone because I'm not close to it. Okay, get your tablet and your pen again.
Okay.
We're going to do another one.
Oh, God.
Right now, I want you to spell jewelry is shiny and then out loud. You're going to say it out loud to me.
Oh.
And the listeners of America and all around the world. And so you're going to spell it out loud and then you're going to write your name down. So do not do them together this time.
Oh, okay.
Do them separately. Okay. Spell out loud, then write your name. Ready?
Okay. So
go.
J-E-W-E-L-R-Y-I-S-S-H-I-N-Y. Writing my name. Done.
Are you ready for the stats, everybody?
Okay, hit me up. How dumb am I?
When Trace had to multitask and do two things at once.
Two things I don't do well.
And with the added pressure of doing it for a recording, it was 24.52 seconds.
Oh my gosh.
When you did it separately, it was 10.17 oh. seconds. So what that has told scientists is that among other research, what they have found is we don't truly multitask. Your brain toggles between tasks. Mm. So when you are doing something like that, that involves a cognitive physical writing task and a speaking out loud task, your brain's not doing both at once. So
no, I was writing a letter and then spelling a little bit and then
yes.
writing a letter. And then the only reason why I picked up on shiny is because Trace Kerr is hella short.
Yeah.
You know, I was done with my name. Oh, man. And then, of course, like I said, spelling is not something I do well anyway. So mm-hmm. then there was that
Either.
Added stress.
Yeah.
Oh, I need to lay down.
I'll talk at you while you rest for a minute. I found a quiz on labinthewild.org. It's a test you can go take. And we'll put this in our show notes because it was kind of fun. It was a multitasking test. And what they had you do was there were drop down menus with shapes that are colors that had the letters in them. So you have a list of letters in a shape. And so then they'd pop up on their screen one for you to go select. So you'd come up to your menu, you'd drop down, find it, click it. So you've got maybe seven menus to choose from and seven things in each menu. So you think that's pretty fast. You just look and go grab it. But they also would occasionally pop some up in a shortcut bar. So your regular menu's on your left and your right-hand menu was a shortcut bar. And they wanted you to grab it from the shortcut bar if it was available. But the shortcut bar would change sometimes. So that was one of your jobs.
Oh, wow.
Initially. I did that a couple times. And then the test introduced, you're going to get a series of letters and numbers before you do the toggling task of choosing. And supposed to memorize that. And at the end, we're going to ask for it again.
Oh.
So you do the whole thing again, saying FX9Y, FX9Y, or however you memorize. And I thought I would crush it at this because multitasking is my life. I'm an office lady. I answer the phone and I answer the door and I help a kid with a bloody nose. And you know, you're doing 82 things at once sometimes in an office.
Yeah.
What they found for me was that my multitasking initially without a memory task, I was 1.2 seconds slower than the rest of the testers. I was crushed. But when you introduced more chaos with the added having to remember numbers, my stats went up. I can't remember how much, but I was better than their average.
Oh, you did better the higher your cognitive load was.
Yeah. Wow. So my brain, I don't know if that means maybe that when I know I have to attend more carefully, I kind of ditch the outliers. The other thing could be I was using a trackpad computer. And I'm better with a mouse. So my stats improved as I went.
That feels like an excuse.
And maybe it is. Yes. I'm good at excuses. So if you want to take that test, and they have all kinds of other completely unrelated tests on Lab in the Wild. It's a fun site. Go test yourself on some fun things.
Wow. That sounds super cool.
It was.
We're going to talk about another cool thing that the brain can do. We've known for a while that some birds, bats, and turtles, and even foxes can sense the Earth's magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
And they can even use it for navigation. Where
like sharks. I've seen a Shark Week show.
Yeah. So they can sense north and south magnetic poles of the Earth and use that sense to orient themselves. Like if you have a long-term migration kind of thing, you would know which way to go. And the way they manage to do this, tiny pieces of magnetite, which is magnetic, in the brain, or cryptochrome molecules in the eyes of these animals.
Mm-hmm.
Cryptochrome, so I was like, what the heck is that? That sounds made up.
Exciting. It sounds like James Bond.
Yeah, like an evil villain would be like, watch out, Mr. Bond, I have cryptochromes.
Yeah, exactly.
They are sensitive to blue light and possibly are involved in the sensing of magnetic fields.
Huh.
And what's cool, too, is depending on where these materials are located in the brain, the animal might even feel the Earth's magnetic field on their faces, like we feel the wind.
Wow.
So, you know, your pigeon might be turning into the field and feeling that field so they know which way to go.
That's crazy.
It's super crazy. Well, here's something that's even more crazy. Humans, some of them have magnetite and or cryptochrome in their brains.
Oh, I'm sorry to put, I do not think I'm one of those people.
Well, you know, you don't know. So Dr. Joe Kirschvink of Caltech, he built a Faraday cage, which blocked out the Earth's magnetic field. So if you were in there, there's no magnetic field at all. And then they used an EEG and they watched the brains of people when he made his own small magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
And some people's brains did respond to the direction of the field.
Wow. Really?
Yes. So, okay. Awesome. So, but now the brain is responding. So that doesn't mean, you know, if I'm in there and they're moving it around, they showed pictures of the EEG scans.
Mm-hmm.
And it was clear that the brain was detecting the field is in front of me and now it's to the right of me. The human beings, none of the people had any perception of this going on. It's definitely something that way back in the day, we were able to use this in some way. But now just some people are detecting it and some people aren't. But yeah.
Wow.
I kind of wonder if this isn't one of those things where, like, my husband, Chaz, has an extremely good sense of direction. Mm-hmm. You know, he walks around a city and he'll be like, oh, we need to go south. And he just turns and he's off, you know, going.
Yes.
And I'm like, what the heck, dude? And unless I have a landmark, I'm not going to be able to do that. And I kind of wonder, they didn't talk about this in the study, but I wonder if those people who are really good at that are somehow,
might not be consciously aware, but you are making decisions based on.
Maybe they're a little more in touch with where their head is pointed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I still posit that I am not one of those people because my aunt and I have been biking together. I think for about 7 years, and we start at her house every time. I still almost run her over on the first corner sometimes.
Because you're like, oh, we're going that way?
Oh, left, sure, okay. Yes, we can go left and not go to the busy street.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all right. Maybe you're just not in touch with your magnetite.
That's sad. Thankful we live in modern times and it's not quite as necessary as it might have been. Let's talk about how the brain forgets. When I was kind of noodling topics, one of the most helpful things I learned in my 4 years of college was how the brain learns, how it remembers things. And so it got me to thinking, how do we forget things? And watching the movie, have you seen the movie Inside Out?
Oh, yes.
One of the animated films. Mm-hmm. And they show memories as little balls in the brain. And one of them gets dropped and rolls away. And it's a core memory. And
what will we do?
Yeah. And we do indeed forget, but it's not quite like that. That is sort of a really broad squint your eyes. And in this topic, if you're in the scientific community and you're like, no, lady, no, please know this is very broad strokes, because anytime you delve into how the brain does a thing,
yeah,
there's so much, and you could go on all kinds of long tangents. So this is a very broad strokes, how your brain forgets. There are two ways that it remembers. One of the ways is recollection. You see a guy and you're like, that is Carpool Michelle Rodriguez from The Y. And you know exactly, she looks like Michelle Rodriguez 10 years down the road with a couple kids, and she probably drives a van. That's, you know, so you know you have a distinct, you know who she is. You see her out in public somewhere, your brain knows.
Right.
That's long-term storage, and it's a recollection. It's a very specific, you have knowledge of it. The other type of memory, familiarity memories, are more of a, that's the guy that works out on the stationary machines down there. Kind of, you don't have a concrete, you don't know that that's Carpool Michelle Rodriguez. You're just like, I think maybe we see him at Target all the time.
Oh, okay.
Those kind of memories. It's just a familiarity. It's not a distinct, has lots of specific facts. So those two kind of memories exist. Your hippocampus is the part of your brain that works on storing and making patterns and encoding. That was another thing with this, is the way that the memories are stored is it doesn't live in a specific location. Like, it's not got a spot. It's more of a clumpy pattern of synapses. So it's sort of a web-like, clumpy-like thing, and it's an encoded pattern. So the process of forgetting is different for both of those types of memories. With the recollection where that is Carpool Michelle Rodriguez, she's the lady at the gym, that kind of memory would be more like on the beach when you've written in the sand and then the waves wash up and wash that gently away. So it sort of starts fraying at the edges. It's not a just chops off and goes away. It's not like the ball in Inside Out that drops off and goes away.
Okay.
It's a gentle decay over time. Whereas with familiarity memories, where you're kind of like, I think I know that guy, those are more like someone comes and sees you writing on the beach and they write over it. And so something takes over it. So this is also where the road of how you have false memories. So interesting. So many roads we could go down that we're not going to today. But the way that forgetting takes place can have some overriding and mixing. So you don't just...
The fact that if you think about it a lot, you can change it.
Yes.
You know, which is kind of disturbing, because then it, you know, I often think, gosh, is anything that I remember actually true?
Mostly, but not totally. That was one thing they said, that most of your memories are slightly altered.
Oh, great.
And that makes sense with the... It's not a specific place. It's more of a web or a mat of synaptic things. And so your connections loosen, retighten somewhere else because of a new experience or a similar experience. When I jammed my pinky finger in grade school, I don't remember if it's fourth grade or sixth grade anymore, but I used to really know for sure. And I can't remember if it was balloon volleyball or balloon basketball, but I know there were balloons.
And there was a pinky, and it was jammed.
It was jammed.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So then how do we, so we forget these things because they're just kind of this blob in the brain, or?
Those synaptic patterns. Now, the more distinct a memory, or the more it doesn't match something else, like traumas, or really unusual, like you might remember your wedding better because you're not having a lot of weddings that you do. Maybe my grandpa had four.
He's like, I don't know. There was cake. Something happened.
He might
happened.
Have some overriding, some recollection and some decay. So the more like a trauma, your brain doesn't have a place to put it. And it's very distinct. So those are a little harder. That decay happens much more slowly because nothing's going to overwrite it. And so it just has to go, unless you have repeated, which is a drag. So create lots of great experiences, really distinct. Like I really remember zip lining. I don't do things like that very often. That's a very distinct memory. So,
yeah, see, that would be imprinted on my brain because it would just be full of terror.
Lots of screaming.
So much screaming. It's a very loud memory.
I was a little worried that there would be like limp Amy at the end of the longest one, because at the place I went, there was like a half mile and they've got a longer one now. And I had to think, as I didn't keep increasing in speed, oh, you have to breathe now or you're going to just pass out. Like nothing bad has happened yet. So it's time to breathe.
Yeah, that would be, huh. Wow.
That's how you forget. The very, very short version.
What were we talking about?
This is clearly a very distinct moment for you.
Okay, so I want to talk about language learning and sleep.
Excellent.
So we had an episode with zebra finches who seem to be learning how to sing their songs by like thinking about them. They're not actually singing out loud, but mm-hmm. they're thinking about them while they're sleeping. They're dream singing, I guess, mm-hmm. would be a clearer way to put it. And Dr. Philip Gilley from the Neurodynamics Lab at the Institute of Cognitive Science at the University of Boulder, Colorado. Woo, that was long. He heard our bird singing episode and he commented on it because he does research on what infants seem to hear in their sleep mm-hmm. and how that seems to have a huge effect on their brain activity and may even shape language learning later in life. So cute. They have pictures on their website of little babies and they've got all these little EEG sensors all over their heads. One's even on the tip of their noses. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, these are some nice babies because they're doing them less than a year old, maybe like less than 6 months old. Mm-hmm. And my children would have been ripping all those wires off. And they have some truly stellar little cherubs that look so happy to have all this equipment on them.
Yeah.
And then they let them go to sleep with all these sensors on. Yeah, 24 infants under the age of 5 months. There we go. And the EEG is attached. They fall asleep. And then infants tend to spend about 80% of their time asleep. So here's mm-hmm. the cool thing they did. So a speaker played a sequence of repeated sounds like ah, 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 or ba, 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 repeating over and over again. And their brains just kind of let that roll through them. Mm-hmm. But they'd insert occasionally this oddball sound like an eh or a da.
Okay.
And the odd sound made a huge shift in their brain waves.
Enough that are they REM sleep during this process?
Well, I didn't see that part, but they're asleep mm-hmm. clearly, and probably they need to be at a certain level of sleep.
But the brain is tuned in suddenly.
The brain goes, whoa, that's a different sound. And once that novel sound was heard a few times, that mm-hmm. they no longer reacted to it because they recognized that sound.
They brought it into their group of, it's cool.
Yeah, so it's kind of recognized as a new pattern. So they feel that new neurological pathways are being built all the time as the brain learns to distinguish these new sounds, because you've mm-hmm. got a pathway that recognizes ah, and then ba, and then eh, and these weird sounds. Mm-hmm. And so that's super important, because discriminating between sounds is how we learn language, because mm-hmm. then it just doesn't sound like blah, you know.
Yes.
It's actually words. The surprise was how quickly their brains got used to these new sounds. Like it only mm-hmm. took a few repetitions of this new sound to have their brain go, yeah, I've heard that before. It's not novel anymore.
Totally makes sense. For some reason, a lot of the students in my Taekwondo class are bilingual, the young kids, and they have a much less distinct accent and a much more concrete grasp on two languages, whereas the adults that come with them are very articulate and intelligent, but that shift is a little bit harder. They are clearly proficient English speakers, but the kids are wizards. They're so fast.
Yep. Although, like when Anson was in kindergarten and preschool, when he was in preschool, there was a child whose dad spoke to him only in German, and dad mm-hmm. was a native German speaker, and mom only spoke to him in Japanese. She was a native Japanese speaker. And then the parents spoke to each other in English. So the children were learning three languages mm-hmm. at one time.
How'd that go for them?
Well, they lagged behind on their learning on all of them. Comprehension was slower. But then when they finally get a grasp of all of them, then they jump ahead.
It's like the little lines in Mario Kart where you hit those lines all of a sudden when the brain kind of coalesces and meshes all of that.
Yep.
They shoot on past.
Yep. And then they're fine. But up till then, you know, it was confused. But what was fun about that kid is he expected dad to speak German and mom to speak Japanese and you to speak English because that's how the routine was. And if you tried to speak something that wasn't English, they would just look at you and be like, that's not the language you're supposed to be using.
You're not a German person in my world.
Just stop it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What a pretender. So
I love the how your brain learns things. It's so fascinating.
It is completely fascinating. Now, I want to share with you something fun.
Okay.
You can grow stronger without exercise.
I'm on board with that because it's getting harder as I get older.
I'm so invested. I was like, wait, I can just think about exercise? So, okay, so this is so cool. Several studies have proven what all us lazy couch potatoes have always wished for.
Okay.
You can exercise without exercising, kinda. Okay. So Dr. Brian Clark at Ohio University, he had a study published in the Journal of Neurophysiology in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
They had 29 volunteers. They wrapped one wrist in surgical cast for an entire month.
Oh, my gosh.
So your wrist is isolated, like if you've broken it.
Uh-huh.
One group did nothing. They just suffered with a wrist in a cast for a month.
Went on with life.
Yep. The other group imagined doing exercises where they were trying to flex their wrist for 11 minutes a day, 5 days a week. They just imagined it.
That would be an interminable 11 minutes.
Right? Because you're like, okay, think curl, think curl. But at the end of 4 weeks, when the casts were removed, those who had imagined the exercises had wrist muscles that were 50% stronger.
Oh my goodness. Okay, that brings me some hope. And that's such a fascinating...
There's more.
There's more?
Yeah. So Dr. Yu at the Cleveland Clinic did something similar with finger exercises. So they were doing with the pinky, the little finger abduction, pinky sit-ups. Okay.
Oh, yes.
And they found that the thinking workout people, okay, so you had the group that didn't do anything with their pinkies, the group who actually did real pinky sit-ups, okay, but the people who thought about it increased their strength by 35%.
Wow.
Real actual pinky sit-ups got you a 53% improvement.
You're almost the same as couch time.
So I got to tell you, I'm like, I'm just going to think about doing sit-ups.
Well, that tells you in the interim, if you're missing a workout or two, do the mental workouts.
Yeah. And, but you have to take the time. You know, clearly you can't
you
be like,
focus on it.
I did 20 sit-ups. You have to be like, sit-up, that kind of thing. Although I do tense my stomach muscles when I do that.
Uh-huh.
But, but wait, there's more.
All right.
In 2009, when Dr. Kai Miller was at the University of Washington, their research showed that imaginary exercise activates the same brain areas that are active during real exercise.
That's what I was just thinking over.
Yeah. So they were looking at this experience of movement for people who have paralysis or stroke victims or people who are learning new sports. You know, thinking about there's been a lot of advancement with prosthetics where they're trying to have a neural connection in some way or a nerve connection in some way so that, yes, if you're thinking, bend my arm, that you could be bending a prosthetic that sort of way.
Yeah. I read an article at some point in the past few years that said, and it was a well-being kind of article, that your brain remembers what it feels like because your brain's perception of a thing is an electrical, it's a synaptic response that's in there. What was happening to your arm comes to your brain through electricity. So if you've had a massage, your brain remembers what that feels like, and you can gain some of the effect of a massage by thinking about what it felt like when the masseuse rubbed their hands over your shoulder blades and up out to your shoulders and back down through the middle, and you can calm yourself down and feel more relaxed simply. And I think it must be the same kind of brain thing. So I've started thinking about that, like, okay, so what if I'd really like a cookie and I just feel like, I just had a really delicious cookie, and you think about what it felt like. Can your brain?
Oh.
I think your brain's pretty amazing.
You might be able to, you know, if you actually spent the time to think about the process of eating the cookie. I don't know if that would be good or bad.
And what it tasted like. I think that it could work if I actually took the time, you know, thinking about that satisfaction of, oh, that was delicious. Because your brain remembers what it tasted like.
Except now, scanning the brain while people performed movement imagery. So like if I imagine doing a sit-up, their brain activity was 25% of that of actual movement. So if you extrapolate this out to your cookie idea, you'd have to imagine eating four cookies to get the satisfaction of eating one cookie.
I can imagine that. It happens. All right. Science working for us today, brain junkies.
So we're on Facebook and Instagram as Brain Junk Podcast, on Twitter as @MyBrainJunk. And if you think we might be a good fit for your public radio lineup, we're now on the PRX Exchange.
Trace and I will catch you next time when we share more of everything you never knew you wanted to know. And I guarantee you will not be bored.
Can you not breathe today?
I'm stuffy. It's spring in Spokane when we're recording, everyone.